Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. In a report released October 12th, the Labor Department reported that 4.3 million Americans quit their jobs in August. And that's the highest number since December of 2000. This is the Great Resignation. But not all sectors of the economy are losing employees equally. Restaurants, bars, and hotels are shedding workers at a particularly high rate. About 1 in 5 of those who resigned in August walked out of hospitality sector jobs. Some weighed their options and departed for higher paying gigs, while others left the industry entirely after serving through the gauntlet of COVID. Many restaurant owners and operators are feeling the effects of the resulting worker shortage.
My name is Gregory Leon, and I'm the chef and owner of Amalinda, a small, independently owned Spanish and Portuguese inspired restaurant in downtown Milwaukee.
Chef Leon told us that due to staffing challenges, he's been unable to restore pre-pandemic hours of operation.
The worker shortage is killing us. I'm currently the only one in the kitchen. So I come in, do all the desserts, and then prep all three stations. And then I've been lucky enough that some of my colleagues and friends have been able to come in and step in on Fridays and Saturdays and help cook with me on the line. There's a smaller pool of people looking for jobs. There's a smaller pool of employees for us to bring into the restaurant. And not only are we dealing with that, but we're also competing with restaurants who did receive the RRF. And so these restaurants who have received the RRF, they're able to pay their employees $17, $18, $20 an hour, where I cannot afford that right now based on business.
The Restaurant Revitalization Fund, or RRF, gave out grants to eligible food businesses during the pandemic. But the funding was not enough. 85% of restaurant and bar applicants were unable to secure a grant, meaning restaurant owners like Gregory are left with little outside help and plenty of stress.
Well, my hair is a lot grayer now, and it's probably falling out at a faster rate than it was before pre-COVID. We've had to modify our menu, so our menu is a lot smaller right now than it normally would be. We've had to simplify some of our dishes just because, you know, there's only so much one person can prep in a day, especially when they're prepping one station. And our guests, it's affecting our guest experience. You know, they're having to wait a little bit longer for their food. And then you run the risk of upsetting the guests and then having the guests not come back. And it's stressful on the other staff members, you know, the front of the house staff.
And this is not just a problem in Wisconsin. Times are tough in neighboring Chicago as well.
I'm Marcos Carvajal, co-owner and president of Carnitas Uruapan Restaurants in Chicago.
Carnitas Uruapan describes themselves as distinctly and unapologetically Mexican. Visit the website, and right next to the expected buttons for menu, catering, and locations is a link to submit your application to work at the restaurant.
We've been fortunate that we were able to retain a lot of longtime staff, albeit, you know, working with reduced hours and, you know, really not 100% back to pre-pandemic levels. But I have noticed that the vacancies that we have had have taken an extremely long time to fill. You know, pre-pandemic, I would put in a job ad and usually be able to find someone, you know, pretty well qualified for a position within 5 days. The last position that I filled took me well over a month to find someone. And, you know, it's never really been that bad. It's really tough to compete as a small independent restaurant, you know, with some of the bigger employers out there that are, you know, offering higher and higher starting salaries for, you know, this essentially the same labor pool.
And even for restaurants not struggling with staffing issues, many other challenges remain due to the pandemic.
My name is Susanna Cotine, and I'm the owner of both Lido and Bixie that are on Frederick Douglass Boulevard in Harlem in Manhattan.
Susanna told us that she's had to deal with a lot of COVID-related red tape with city officials.
We've been able to get by on our staff. Sometimes it's a little tight, but we've been lucky that a lot of our people came back when, you know, we were open full swing. You know, New York City continues to be really, really difficult to have a small business in, and the amount of inspectors that come in and just a surprise visit. And I just had somebody come in the other day. I was literally in a meeting with a bank regarding a loan, and somebody came in and handed me a paper that said I had to take my outside houses down from the Department of Transportation. And it was just such a shock and devastating, because we spent a ton of money on that. And that's a huge, you know, source of revenue for us right now. And, you know, we're still trying to dig out of a hole from the pandemic.
And it's not just the restaurants and their owners who are struggling. Workers in the food service industry face long hours, late nights, and sometimes low pay, minimal benefits, and hostility from customers and even from managers. In a May 2021 survey from One Fair Wage and the UC Berkeley Food Labor Research Center, a majority of restaurant workers said they're leaving due to low wages and tips. The next highest ranked reasons people left their restaurant jobs were COVID health risks and concerns of hostility or harassment. And when we put out the question to you out there about whether restaurant worker shortages are affecting you, here's what some of you had to say.
Hey, it's Mark Hooper calling from Little Rock, Arkansas. Yeah, the worker shortage has affected me, but not in the way that you would expect it to. I contributed to the worker shortage. Pandemic hit, and I got out of the restaurant bar business. I used to be a bar manager and a bartender, and I walked away from it. I knew that my state wasn't going to do anything to help support bartenders or restaurants during the pandemic. I was right, and now I work for the United States Post Office.
Hi, my name is Doran O'Donnell, and I live in Grants Pass, Oregon. I own a small restaurant bar called The Speakeasy, and we have had a hard time keeping employees, and there have been many times where we've had to shut down because we didn't have the people to work.
Hi, my name is Rachel Wilson, and I own Giggle Waters in Safety Harbor, Florida. We've really bounced back from a volume perspective since the shutdown. I mean, the lines are out the door. People are ready to go out. They want to have a fun night out. They're there to support us. But staffing is a bear right now. I've never seen anything like it. We've certainly increased our wages. We're doing all we can to attract the right people. I'm posting everywhere for job fairs. We maybe get one or two people who show up for interviews, and then hopefully one of them will actually come in and start. We used to go into a Saturday night with 10 servers on. Now we'll go in with maybe four sometimes.
Now, even as we hear those voices of the restaurant industry, it's critical to understand the ways COVID exacerbated issues already plaguing restaurant workers for decades. The policy of a subminimum wage for tipped workers means many servers earn as little as $2.13 per hour before tips. And because servers rely on tips in an industry that's not required to provide for a living wage, many workers find themselves enduring astonishing levels of harassment. Saru Jayaraman is president of One Fair Wage and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley, and is author of One Fair Wage, Ending Subminimum Pay in America. Saru, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So talk to me here. As you listen to our restaurant workers and restaurant owners, what are kind of your initial responses?
Well, I would say the majority of the voices we heard were owners. We heard from one worker and mostly owners. And that has been sort of the, you know, I think during the pandemic, mostly we are hearing from owners talking about their struggles. And I think it's really important to lift up workers and exactly what you said, Melissa, that they have been struggling with a crisis in this industry long before the pandemic. I think owners definitely struggled during the pandemic. I would say the struggles of workers were crisis level before the pandemic, and with the pandemic, people lost their homes, lost their, you know, ability to feed their children. I mean, the struggle and crisis got so much worse. But listen, before the pandemic, as you said, we had this direct legacy of slavery in our industry. You know, at emancipation, the restaurant lobby wanted the ability to hire newly freed slaves, not pay them anything, and have them live entirely on tips. And so they created this very unique system in America. We're the only country that does it, allowing restaurants to pay little or nothing and having workers live on tips. And so we went from $0 at emancipation as an attempt to hire Black people for free, all the way up to the ridiculous $2.13 an hour today and even before the pandemic, you're talking about an overwhelmingly population of women struggling with the highest rates of sexual harassment and poverty of almost any industry in the US. Well, with the pandemic, these workers, first, many of them were not able to access unemployment insurance. Two-thirds of the workers we surveyed, and we surveyed 250,000 workers after the pandemic shutdown, two-thirds told us they couldn't get unemployment insurance because in most states they were told their wages were too low to qualify for benefits. And when they did go back, they found that tips had gone way down because sales were down and harassment and hostility had gone way up. And I could say a lot more about that, but that combination really became, frankly, life-threatening. And you saw mass exodus last year itself.
Saru, before we get to the question of the harassment, can you explain just one tick more on the unemployment insurance issue?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was really a moment of epiphany for so many workers, because when you get a wage of $2 or $3 an hour, as it is in 43 states, including blue states like New York and Illinois and Massachusetts, have a subminimum wage that's a direct legacy of slavery. So you're talking about, anywhere from $2 to $5 in most states. New York, the wage is 66% of the wage, all a direct legacy of slavery. Well, these workers, you know, they lived most of their income. The vast majority of their income was from tips. That small wage, that subminimum wage, was so low, it often went entirely to taxes and they were living off their tips. And when they went to go apply for unemployment insurance, most states told them, it looks like you earn too little to qualify for benefits. It looks like you didn't work enough hours. So at the start of the pandemic, you know, when the pandemic shutdown occurred, about 6 million restaurant workers lost their jobs. That's one in four Americans who lost their jobs was in the restaurant industry when the pandemic shut down the economy last March. And we heard from so many workers. One was a woman named Sarah May from Michigan, worked in a small dive bar in a small town in Michigan, and told us that she had religiously reported her tips to the IRS. The wage in Michigan is $3.52 an hour. But when she went to apply for unemployment insurance, she was told that her employer never reported her tips. And it looked like she had just earned that $3 wage. And so in total, it looked to the state of Michigan that she had not actually worked in full time. She had not worked enough hours to qualify for benefits. So she couldn't get state unemployment insurance. Then when federal unemployment insurance came out, it was supposedly not based on your income. It was supposed to be just on loss of a job. She was told she'd be eligible for that, but because it came through the state of Michigan system and she was marked as a denial by the state of Michigan, she was never able to access those funds. And so this is the incredible, outrageous irony of the moment. Here you have some people claiming, oh, these workers are lazy, staying home, collecting unemployment insurance, when the truth is a huge majority of these workers never received it or received very little because their wages were so low. And it was at that moment, that was the beginning of the exodus. We heard from so many workers at that moment last spring, wait a second, if the government is telling me I earn too little to qualify for benefits like everybody else who's been working full-time or more than full-time, then probably I earn too little if the state is telling me that. And I should never have put up with this subminimum wage to begin with. And so when we did the survey you mentioned this May, surveying 3,000 workers and, you know, 54% of those who remain in the industry. And mind you, so many left last year, but this year, 54%, more than half of those who remain in the industry say they're leaving. And 78%, nearly 8 in 10, say the primary thing that's going to make them stay in the industry or come back to work in restaurants is a full minimum wage with tips on top. So there has been this just moment of epiphany. Wait a second. If everybody's saying I earn too little, the government is saying I earn too little to get benefits. And then on top of that, you want me now to enforce social distancing and mask rules and COVID vaccination card rules on the same customers from whom I'm supposed to get tips to make up my income. But even with those tips, I'll never be considered earning enough to actually qualify for benefits for everybody else. Honestly, I'm done. And you can take this job and shove it.
All right. Talk to me. Expand on that aspect that is the requirement of front of the house workers to enforce the masking rules. What is masking harassment?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, it's important to note that our industry had the highest rates of sexual harassment of any industry in the United States prior to the pandemic. We work closely with Professor Catherine McKinnon, who's many people know, legendary law professor who really coined the term sexual harassment and spent her life trying to make it illegal in the United States. And she did research with us, and she, in her words, the rate of sexual harassment in our industry among tipped workers dwarfs all other sectors, including the military, because you have this overwhelmingly women that must tolerate inappropriate customer behavior to feed their families in tips. And the connection to the tip minimum wage is very clear when you look at the 7 states that got rid of the subminimum wage many decades ago. California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska require full minimum wage with tips on top, have for decades, not only have higher small business growth rates, lost fewer restaurants during the pandemic, but also have 1/2 the rate of sexual harassment in the industry, because their women can count on a wage from their boss like every other worker in every other industry. They don't have to put up with as much from male customers. They're not as dependent on the tip. And it was that power dynamic between women servers and male customers that got so much worse with the pandemic, because with tips way down, because sales are down, and now this added responsibility to tell customers, put on a mask, sit 6 feet apart. Now I need to see your COVID vaccination card. You know, the power dynamic of I need to get tips from these very same people resulted in really a very ugly situation, in which we heard from thousands of women, I am repeatedly asked on every shift by male customers, take off your mask so I can see how cute you are before I decide how much to tip you. Take off your mask so I can see the pretty face of my server before I decide how much to tip. And what was truly intolerable in the past, you know, outrageous, humiliating, now became a matter of life and death. And so naturally, many people said, that's it, I'm done. You are asking me to expose myself and my children and my family to the virus for the opportunity, for the chance at earning an income, when I can go work in another industry and at least get the minimum wage or more from my employer without having to expose myself in this way for the chance to get a tip.
In our last moments here, what is the Raise the Wage Act?
Yeah, so there, I think what's incredible about this moment, the silver lining about this moment is that we are seeing this, we're calling it a wage shortage, not a worker shortage. There are workers, they just won't work for these wages. This resulting in thousands of restaurants now raising their wages across the country. And this needs to be driving policy. The federal Raise the Wage Act needs to follow employers who are paying this and saying we can't do it alone. In New York State, Governor Hochul can move in this direction, and the subminimum wage for tipped workers. Multiple states are looking at this. This is the time to support workers who are saying we can't come back without this, and small business restaurants who are saying we're paying these wages, but we're raising wages, but we need the government to make this a level playing field and signal to workers it is worth coming back to work in restaurants.
Saru Jayaraman is the president of One Fair Wage and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.